Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here from our perch in 2023. I am one of your hosts, Phil Lisko.
I'm your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in for your regular host, Phil, but he's playing Bob Cratchit for some reason.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
At least it's a Tiny Tim.
What if you hosted this with yourself, but you were playing a different character? Like, that would be great.
I don't think anyone wants that. But with us today, Clay Keller, Tom Meissen are both here. It should be said that I reached out to both of you very early on in the process of figuring out who wants what movies, and both of you demanded Muppet Christmas Carol right out of the gate. It wasn't even a question. You guys didn't, I'm not sure right. You even looked at the rest of the list. I think you saw Muppet Christmas Carol and you were like, I need to plant my flag. So there was no choice but to have the two of you on to talk about this film, obviously. What is it about? I mean, when did you first see it? I mean, I'm assuming you were both children when you saw this film?
Who is that question mark aimed towards?
Both of you, Clay and Tom. But one of you speak.
Who's older? Who we don't know. Who's older between Tom and I?
Well, I'm mid to late 30s, early 40s.
that's a big swan. That's the most accurately thing you've ever said, Tom.
I'll call my agent and find out how old I'm meant to be.
I was a child, yes, Phil, to answer your question.
Yes.
When did this come out? 1992?
It came out in December of 1992.
December of 1992, yeah. I guess I'll go first. I would have seen this. I do not believe I saw this in theaters. I would have seen this on VHS tape. Actually, I have the VHS tape
clamshell
behind me here, right there.
I noticed that.
Would have seen this on VHS, and this was... I don't even know how we acquired this because we weren't a big Muppets household. Neither of my parents were big Muppets people. I think the initial run of Muppets came kind of when they were in their later teens, kind of in high school. And so they didn't really have a relationship with the Muppets themselves. So I'm glad you're all sitting down. I did not see the Muppet movie until lockdown, which is...
Sure.
Somewhat insane. I had seen The Muppet Christmas Carol 500 times, and I had not seen The Muppet movie until lockdown.
Did this open up The Muppets for you?
This was absolutely my siblings' primary exposure to The Muppets. I think we got, at some point, there was maybe Pizza Hut or Domino's was sliding DVDs into their pizzas, and we got the Great Muppet Caper, I want to say.
Sure.
That's how I have Muppets Take Manhattan. It was in a cereal box. And I was like, what is this doing in there?
Manhattan, that's the one.
Giving
Emily,
Muppet
that's the
shit
one.
Away, though.
It was like a free DVD stuck in a in a food product.
It was like a Willy Wonka thing where Disney was giving away the rights to the Muppets because they weren't doing anything with them, and it was like in a cereal box. And if you got cereal box, you would just own the Muppets.
But I think
you make it sound really nice as opposed to just some really slaggy corporate nerd.
No, they weren't actually giving away the Muppets, but it was very much like, we don't know what to do with these, so we're just gonna put the movies in cereal box.
But yeah, to answer your question, Phil, this and It's a Wonderful Life, these were my Christmas movies. These were the annual, every year Christmas movies. So yeah, I saw this movie every year from the time I was 3 years old until 2 weeks ago.
So Tom, what was your first exposure to this film?
In the cinema in 1992.
Yeah.
And then 1993, got it on VHS and watched it every Christmas since.
So
every Christmas since. When I was a child, every Christmas. When I was a teenager, my brother also loved it. So he'd always just put it on and say, oh my God, come on, Christmas. And I go, oh my God, fucking Christmas. But sit and watch it and love it and cherish it. And then as an adult, I got it on DVD when they cut Love Is Gone, which I'm sure we'll come to.
I assume that's most of what this conversation will be about, Tom.
I can absolutely believe it.
And then now
I watch it with my son. So now
he loves it.
Loves it. It's his favorite as well.
Okay. Now, Emily, I know that you are the queen of Christmas. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that this is probably not your Christmas movie, but like. Is it in the pantheon?
I like this movie okay. And here's the thing. I love the fucking Muppets. I am in the exact right, because for some reason, one of the local stations where I grew up aired the Muppet Show for many years after it ended in syndication. Sure. So I grew up watching that. I grew up watching Muppet Babies. I'm the exact right age for Muppet Babies to have been a thing for me. I saw the movies. Weirdly, I also didn't see the Muppet movie until I was an adult, but I saw the other ones. I saw this not in theaters, but, shortly after it came out on VHS. I think this is a very charming movie. At the time, I was very cognizant of Jim Henson's death. That was like the first big death I was aware of. Sure. So like I saw this movie through the prism of that and was like, the voices are all wrong. And now I don't care about that. But like at the time, it was a big deal for me. I loved the Muppet Family Christmas TV special from 87 or 88, is Jim Henson's last appearance with the Muppets. And it's so beautiful and so wonderful. And like I cherish that. In the way I think a lot of people cherish this, but I've really come around. I used to not like this movie, and I've come around on it. I think it's good. All of my problems with it stem from the stupidest thing, which we will get to in a moment.
Great,
I'm sure.
Can't wait. I do think we've done a.
You're going to ruin Christmas from Emily because you're so fucking eloquent
and
thoughtful. I know that you're not only going to destroy every Christmas I've had since I was 10, but also all Christmases from now on, and my child's Christmases. And
that's the Christmas spirit. That's what I'm going to bring to Christmas.
This is coming out on Christmas Eve, and I hope I ruin everyone's Christmas. No, I cannot stress enough how dumb my reason for not really digging this movie is.
Truly, I can't wait. But I do think that we've done kind of a string of movies over the last little while, Emily, of sort of, I don't like pretty beloved films that Emily comes in and goes, I like this movie fine. Hold on. Sneakers. A League of Their Own.
I love A League of Their Own. Okay. That one's in my top.
Batman Returns.
Five. Yeah. Yeah.
Emily, I'm with you on Batman Returns.
It's nice. It's good. I do think it's interesting.
We don't need to relitigate. We did 3 hours on Batman Returns. But I do think that what's interesting is I thought there were more Muppet movies than there are.
Mm-hmm. Oh no.
Which I think is just kind of because of how sort of ubiquitous they are. But it's Muppet Movie, Great Muppet Caper, Muppets Take Manhattan, Muppet Christmas Carol, Muppet Treasure Island, Muppets from Space, and then the two kind of like new ones, which was the Muppets and Muppets Most Wanted. And I think it's so funny because I feel like online there's always people being like, we should do a Muppet version of X, right? Mm-hmm. Like Muppets do this, Muppets do that. But the Muppets only did it twice. Like it seems as though there's like a whole genre of Muppets redoing things.
They did. There was TV stuff. There was a Wizard of Oz. Yes, they did. And was there one other one or is it just the Wizard of Oz?
They did Wizard of Oz. They did a riff on It's a Wonderful Life, which is not It's a Wonderful. But like,
fair enough.
I do think like, It did seem like it was going to be a profitable way for them to continue to be. And then they, after Muppets Treasure Island, which is very good. I like that movie too. They did Muppets in Space, which is a disaster. So
Muppets from Space was which we covered on our 99 podcast and is a straight up like bad movie. It's like Muppets doing Austin Powers in a weird way. Like it's just the tone is all off.
Right.
And it was a disaster like at the box office. And it was really kind of the moment when everyone was like, I guess we're done with Muppets. And it's not until
Jason Segel shoved them in cereal boxes.
But like then Jason Segel kind of brings it back. But like, I still feel like people don't really know what to do with them. Like the shows on Disney Plus don't seem to really be working. And there was an ABC show.
Probably so many people think doing the Muppets is easy. Correct. And think that when Jim Henson era Muppets was easy because it's just mucking about, having a laugh, telling some jokes, much like pantomime over here. People think doing pantomime is easy and those people do it really badly. And it's actually incredibly complicated. And doing the Muppets, well, it's incredibly complex.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's also a real like balancing act of tone, like, because if you go back to like the Muppet Show, right, which was its own sort of pastiche of kind of talk show 70s kind of what have you, that just doesn't hit today. Like I don't know that you can do that again.
I think like it's the Muppet Show, which is where from whence the Muppets originate, because obviously they had existed before that, but like our conception of the Muppets as an entity comes from the Muppet Show. It was very grounded in vaudeville and variety shows and that kind of performance, which is an idiom we just don't have anymore. Like my child, who is one who doesn't have a lot of understanding of dramatic storytelling, is going to grow up in a world where none of that happened. I sort of feel similarly about The Simpsons, where like the lingua franca they exist within is the family sitcom of the 50s through 80s, and that increasingly just doesn't exist. And like obviously there are many reasons that show is kind of a limp husk of what it was, although I hear it's gotten good again. I need to like check that out. But like,
Emily, people say that every 6 years.
This time it's from people where I'm like, they might actually know.
It's true.
Yeah, okay. But like, and the thing is, if you watch even episodes from the really shitty years, they're still like fine. It's just that like that idiom, the family sitcom, is now not around anymore. So it's no longer subverting anything. It's become the thing that's being subverted. If the only example you have of vaudevillian style storytelling is the Muppets, then there's like there's nothing left there for them to be satirizing. Sure. So like they keep trying to come up with like putting them in. I do think the early movies, this is me talking a lot about the Muppets, but I do think the early movies where they put them in different genres, like we're doing a road movie, now we're doing a caper movie, now we're doing a musical. I think that's kind of the way to go with them, but that requires you to have an understanding of them as characters that I'm not sure culturally exists anymore. So it's an Ouroboros of a problem.
Well, they did do the sequel to the Jason Segel movie was the Muppets in a prison film, which was put them in a gulag movie. That was a bold good? Choice.
I never saw it.
I prefer the first one.
Yeah,
really? I like the first one fine. Yeah. I enjoyed the first one.
Muppets Most Wanted. Even Ricky Gervais comes out of that looking okay. I like that movie.
I think a sequel is one of the Muppets' best songs as well. I love that song.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Sure.
Absolutely.
It is interesting in regards to Christmas Carol, how like it's sort of a weird thing for them to put the Muppets into. And I think it works, but I do think it's a bit of a risk in the sense that the Muppets themselves are kind of bit players in this. Like
Here we go. Here we go. Go ahead.
Okay. Oh, is this your big thing? I don't say that this is a bad thing, but it is sort of interesting to me when Miss Piggy shows up really deep into the movie, you're just sort of like, oh, right, this is a Muppet movie. Like it's Gonzo is probably the most sort of prevalent one because he narrates the movie. But like
And yet he's not particularly Gonzo-esque.
No.
You know.
It is fascinating to me because if you look at sort of the trajectory that you just sort of outlined, Emily, of like, you know, Muppet Movie, Muppet Caper, Muppets Take Manhattan, it's not a foregone conclusion that this is necessarily the right tact. It works. Don't get me wrong. I really enjoyed this film. And also, for the record, for our listeners, I'd never seen this film before. So this was my first time seeing The Muppet Christmas Carol.
What? Wait, Phil, if I had known that, okay, you watched the correct version, yes?
I watched the version on Disney Plus, and then I watched the song, which is separate. It's like a special
feature. No, Disney Plus, if you go into the special features, there's a full 4K. It's all put together. It's all a complete film on Disney Plus. Yes.
Last year, I watched
Phil, this is why you need to let us know these things so we can put you on the right path.
I'm sorry?
Oh, Christ.
Yes, Tom, you were
this
saying?
This is all ruined.
I think they got rid of the song again. Last year, I watched it on Disney Plus and it had the song, and this year, rewatched it.
The song was like, it's a special feature where you can watch it after.
So, like, last year it was with the song, and now they've switched it back to you watch it without, but in the special features is the full movie.
Gentlemen, I watched it on Disney Plus 2 weeks ago, and it had the song, but you have to go into the extras.
Yeah.
And it's called, like, the complete version or something.
That's my mistake, and I apologize.
I just got a text from Bob Iger. We're speaking again after the strike. He said Phil fucked up. So
I fucked up. But it was interesting watching this film. Obviously, I know A Christmas Carol. I've seen iterations of it many, many times over.
Right.
I think this is probably, and I still have one more to watch, which Emily and I are going to talk about on our Patreon. So maybe that one is going to be the best one. But as of right now, this is probably my favorite version of A Christmas
Carol. All right, Phil, all is forgiven.
But I watching it, I was just really sort of surprised that Kermit and Miss Piggy aren't as big a role. Now, all that being said, their storyline is so emotionally potent that I think it works. But it is sort of surprising that, like, Kermit's not, like, you know.
Well, I think one of the reasons they took this approach, Phil, is going back to talking about what Tom was saying, how difficult it is to do the Muppets, is because the Muppets really were, I mean, they were Henson. They were Henson and Frank Oz and Jerry Jewell and Steve Gould. And those original people all that formed that group at the beginning, that's so born out of their personalities and their chemistry and their kind of unique skew on the world. And I think, I mean, if I'm remembering correctly, one of the reasons they chose to go this way for the first post Jim Henson project kind of was because it decentralized some of the personalities of certainly Henson, who is no longer there. So Kermit not only is sort of has a diminished role, but is also not really Kermit. It's Kermit playing Bob Cratchit. Right. And they threw around a lot of ideas and wanted to do, I think it was before Henson died, he had sort of expressed, if I'm remembering this correctly, like he liked doing these Christmas things like the Emma Daughter and the family Christmas and everything. And that doing a big screen Christmas thing was on like the idea board. And they were like, sure. Oh, this is a perfect, I think it was maybe Jerry Jewell was just like, I love the Christmas Carol. And they're like, oh, and it was just kind of like a flash of inspiration. But and that's why this works for me. Also, this was my first Christmas Carol and my first Muppets. So none of the problems that people, you know, none of the preconceived anything that people bring into this affected me at all watching this, which is the perfect way to, you know, come in uncritically and just have this become part of your, you know, DNA, like for myself and Tom.
You know, you sort of hinted at the development, and it is interesting that so Henson dies in May of 90. And apparently a talent agent, Bill Haber, approached Brian Henson, the son.
I think he was Brian's agent.
Yes, with an adaptation of A Christmas Carol. And it was going to be an ABC TV movie. So similar to sort of what you guys were talking about, of them doing sort of more TV-oriented stuff. And then once the script was submitted, the executives at Disney purchased the script and said, we want to do this as a feature instead. And then Jerry Jewell was hired to write the script. And it's interesting that it feels like this speaks to what you're talking about, Clay, of Jim always wanted to do a Christmas thing and Brian saw an opportunity to be able to sort of have his cake and eat it too, right? Do a Christmas thing with the Muppets, but reduce them a little bit so that it didn't feel as though it was as sort of onerous on the people that that have been doing it previously. The Michael Caine.
Not only that, but he was probably, he must have been shitting himself.
100%.
He was 25, 26?
Yeah.
Was he really?
20. Yeah, sorry. He was young. He was in his 20s. Yeah.
He was in his 20s. I maintain, I've said this before and I'll say it again. I think this is one of the best debut features.
Yeah, I don't know how
that I've seen. This is a beautifully made movie.
Yeah.
I agree with that. I mean, whenever I watch anything with the Muppets, and obviously many people have spoken about the moment when Kermit rides a bicycle in the Muppet movie, everyone's brains just kind of exploded because they were like, I don't understand how you did this. And I do find every time I watch any sort of Muppet thing, I'm like, I don't really know how you're pulling this off, because it's just, unlike animation or whatever, this is tactile. Like, this is done with like actual physical puppets. And I just can't even imagine what it's like to do it. Seems like a nightmare to me. I want to give a little bit of context for this. The Muppets perform the classic Dickens holiday tale with Kermit the Frog playing Bob Cratchit, the put-upon clerk of stingy Ebenezer Scrooge played by Michael Caine. Other Muppets, Miss Piggy, Gonzo, Fozzie Bear, and Sam the Eagle weave in and out of the story while Scrooge receives visits, from spirits of the three Christmases, past, present, and future. They show him the errors of his self-serving ways, but the miserable old man seems to be past any hope of redemption and happiness. The Muppet Christmas Carol opened on December 11th, 1992, against A Few Good Men, Home Alone 2, The Bodyguard, Aladdin, and of course, The Mighty Ducks. This is why I got crushed at the box office.
What a fucking marquee.
Didn't it make a little bit of money? Like, it was not like a huge flop, but it was like...
It goes on to make $27 on a $12 million budget. So, you know what I mean? Like, no one lost their shirts on this, but I think that, obviously, they're like, we have to release Christmas Carol at Christmas time. And that's all fine and good, but I don't think they could have imagined that like they were going to get just crushed by Aladdin and Home Alone 2.
I feel like
Released Aladdin. I would have hoped they would have had some inkling of an idea.
That's true. Sorry,
I feel like this is right before the era when if you release a Christmas movie somewhere after the first weekend in November, it will just play and play and play and play into about mid-January. Even like 5 years later, if they had released this movie in late November, like around Thanksgiving, it would have just like
That's when Home Alone 2 comes out. Home Alone 2 comes out in the Thanksgiving corridor, right. And it just crushes.
They probably thought they were getting out of Home Alone 2's way, and then Home Alone 2 goes on to make $500 million or whatever the fuck.
And Aladdin's still making money. It came out in the fucking summer. Aladdin, or wasn't it the summer?
It came out the week before Home Alone 2, I believe.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
But Aladdin, I mean, again, I think they just imagined that there'd be room for it at this point, right? What they probably should have done is actually released it like on Christmas, like given it another week or so, and maybe it might have been able to do a little bit better. But it's got 77% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 86% from audiences. Roger Ebert gave the film 3 stars and said, curious that Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol should be the most beloved of all fiction Christmas stories. It's a tale of gothic gloom, relieved only by the end and the warmth of holiday cheer. Like all the Muppet movies, this one is a musical with original songs by Paul Williams. It could have done with a few more songs than it has, like the one that was cut that we'll talk about. And the merrymaking at the end might have been carried on a little longer, just upset the gloom of most of Scrooge's tour throughout his lifetime spent spreading misery. Will the kids like the movie? The kids around me in the theater seem to, although more for the Muppets than for the cautionary tale of Scrooge. Well, yes.
Surprising.
That tracks. I guess the question I have for you guys is, what do you think it is about the Muppets that is so special? Like, what is that? I know it's a big question, but like, what is that sort of, what's the secret sauce? Speak at once.
I think it's Henson and Oz. I think obviously they have continued to exist as characters and people continue to love them and enjoy them. And I think there have been good Muppet things made since Jim Henson died, including this, although this features everybody else. Frank Oz is still there doing stuff, etc. I think it's Henson and Oz. They're amazing performers. They're amazing performers together. Sure. And, You know,
was Oz involved in Treasure Island? Sorry to interrupt you.
I don't remember. I'd have to.
I think Oz didn't stop doing the voices until Most Wanted. He stopped puppeteering at some point, but then he would do the voice over
the voices.
But he stopped very recently. Like, I think it might have been Most Wanted was the first one he didn't do, or maybe even something some TV thing after that. But yeah, he kept going for a while.
So yeah, he does the voices. Voice only is what it says on Muppet Treasure Island. So I'm assuming
he's
no longer
puppeteering.
He's stopped puppeteering after this.
You know? There's a sense of anarchy to them, I think, that is very... I think the problem with anarchic characters is they cease to be anarchic because they become normalized in a weird way. Like, nobody thinks of Mickey Mouse, could ever think of Mickey Mouse as anarchic. But, like, his early movies, he's kind of a piece of shit. And then, like... Bugs Bunny comes along and supplants that. And now Bugs Bunny is also a corporate mascot. The thing about these characters, Bart Simpson's another one. They just become, this corporate thing that people can implant can put their own feelings onto. And I think Kermit, I think, was interesting because he was always the guy at the center of the chaos. And I think that's why the Muppets have managed to maintain some of that anarchy, because Kermit always plays as the straight man to them. He's the Bob Newhart of the Muppets. But I think it's that anarchic quality that people loved and that is hard to keep going, especially once the original creators are gone.
Yeah, that all makes sense to me. I mean, I've seen almost all the movies. I haven't seen Treasure Island. That's the only one I think I haven't seen.
Tim Curry is an actor probably most suited to working with Muppets. Yeah, outside of Michael Caine, who
Treasure Island is, Phil, you'll like it. It is, in terms of the production, it's every bit as cinematic, and Henson just does a killer job. I think the script isn't as funny as Muppet Christmas Carol. But it's, the production is just lavish. They do an incredible job. He, on those two movies, Henson just did a killer job.
You know, to your point, Tom, I think it's interesting because there was this quote that was floating around as I was doing some research on it about how Michael Caine performs as though the Muppets are actors as well, right? Like, that he's sort of a consummate actor in the way that he approaches it. He's a straight man, whereas Tim Curry thinks he's a Muppet. So he performs like a Muppet.
Yeah, well, funnily enough, Home Alone 2 that you mentioned earlier, we watched it this afternoon.
Oh, okay.
And, as we said earlier, you play the game of if this film were a Muppet film, who would be the one actor? And we did this when we were on a walk the other day, and my son said, well, they're all Muppets except for Kevin. It's got to be Kevin is the one who isn't a Muppet. But then watching it, he said, no, that guy has got to be in it. And it's having another Muppet. He's perfect.
He stands out in Home Alone 2, a movie that
he stands out in everything. He's genuinely one of my favorite actors ever. And if you don't believe me, watch Congo.
He's perfect. He, I still best know him for doing a voice in one of my favorite computer games when I was a teenager. And he does it with the world's most ridiculous Southern accent, but it's perfect. He's just like, I've been thinking about Nolans. And you're like, good work, Tim Curry. I love you. I love you. Please be my boyfriend. I think this is another thing the Muppets have over other similar characters. They can interact with human beings. Like, I was looking back at what are the other Muppet things I've liked in the last however many years. Lady Gaga and the Muppets Christmas special to me is a thing that the Muppets should do more of. Let's find a celebrity. Let's do an old fashioned variety special, probably around the holidays. The Muppets are there. They're hanging out with someone. And Lady Gaga is so good at playing off the Muppets. And here Michael Caine's so good. So I think the fact that they can interact with real people is a thing they have that other characters
and that
don't.
goes back to the unique process that Jim Henson pioneered, which is it's not a puppet. It's the and you'll see this. I don't know if any of you have seen this. Tom, obviously you don't live in Los Angeles, but maybe have you ever been to the Henson studio and seen Brian Henson's
puppet? I've driven
past
it many times.
But have you been to see his show, his puppet up show? So he every maybe four times a year. They do a weekend and they do like two or three shows per day, per like Saturday and Sunday. And it is in a soundstage on the Muppet Studios. And you can just get a ticket and go.
Tom Spaces.
And it's, right, it's no, it's incredible. It is a puppet improv show. That is, the pitch is sort of like, it's a for adults pup, like it's not puppet. It's, sure, it's, you know, they can't say Muppet because that's Disney owns that word, but it's a puppet improv show that Henson does with a bunch of other really, really, really incredible, funny people. A lot of the people who are currently working as Muppeteers, you know, on official Muppet things,
Muppet business.
But it is, it's not nearly as raunchy as they pitch it. It's not just like, ooh, aren't we being, you know, naughty. It's a fascinating look at how they do this, because this process that Henson created is that the Muppeteers never, you don't see them. They are out of sight. They're underneath the floor. They're inside of a barrel. They're behind a thing, and they watch a television. Everything they do is off of this monitor that they have in front of them, and they learn how to interact with people via this monitor. So any actor, any person who comes in here, and everybody, look, Michael Caine gives an incredible performance in this movie. I think he's astounding. But every year on Twitter, the entire time leading up to Christmas, it's a bunch of people getting 10,000 likes with some variation of Michael Caine didn't have to go this hard, but blah, 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 or only Michael Caine, he's doing Shakespeare, blah, blah, blah. Everybody, look at the Muppet Show. You look at Lady Gaga. You look at, it is the magic. Again, Phil, to your question, what makes the Muppets unique? It's this process that Henson pioneered and then like slavishly made everybody at all of his, you know, people adhere to. It's you have to do it this way. Is the Muppet becomes real because of the way they do this. You just forget that this is not a real thing that you are interacting with, and it makes almost any person seem like an incredible actor playing it totally serious with these goofy puppets, because of the way Henson created it.
Exactly. You're so right that, you know, all the time people say the famous quote of Michael Caine saying, I'm going to play it like I'm in the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Right.
And his way of interacting with the Muppets is what makes it so special, when no, you're completely right. It's how the Muppets interact with him that makes it work. He just has to look at the Muppet eyes rather than down at the person with the hand up the Muppet ass.
You know, it's interesting. All the stuff you guys are talking about makes me feel like I have not watched the Disney Plus Muppet stuff. Now, I believe there is actors like the Muppet Mayhem stuff, and I forgive me, I'm not as well versed in it, but I do feel like a variety show, the Muppet Show, is the best possible version of what we're talking about, because all of these, all the clips you've seen or all the shows you've watched, all the actors are fully committed to the bit, right? Like the pure joy and the fun of being a human treating these Muppets like real people is just, it's so joyous and childlike. I mean, it's just, it's imagination personified. I think that we've lost that. There's a bit of a cynicism now, and the Muppets are trying to sort of, I hate to say it, but trying to be cool as opposed to leaning into what makes them great. And I wonder whether or not that's getting lost in it too.
That'll never work. I think the magic dust of the old Muppet Show was, and the reason they were so real when they were on stage, quote unquote, is that we see them backstage trying to get it put on.
Right.
And so that adds a completely, I mean, I don't know when Henson came up with the idea or why, but it's absolute genius to say we're going to watch them try and get the show put on and watch them failing, and then we'll go out the front and we'll see the show. And because we've seen backstage, because we've seen Miss Piggy in the dressing room, we believe her so much more when she's on stage that it's an actual performer. And then you can bring in whoever you want, and it's two actual performers together.
Mm-hmm. The show, the 2015 show, which is a mockumentary office style show, didn't work
on ABC, right?
Yeah, on ABC. Yeah, it didn't work, but it came close to figuring out how to do that in a modern context. And like, if they had gotten three more seasons, they would have gotten there. But like that show, I mean, now you don't have time to figure that shit out. It has to be there from episode one, and they weren't there from episode one. But like, I felt like the DNA of that had the right show in it.
You know who probably loves all this behind the scenes stuff is Aaron Sorkin. Aaron Sorkin.
Oh my God. Aaron Sorkin. Okay, listen. Listen. Mm. Everybody knows my feelings on Aaron Sorkin, but if he wanted to do a hyper, like, sincere Muppets style show, like, it's just.
Would watch.
It's Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, but with the Muppets, and also Bradley Whitford's there. Yes. No, it has to be Amanda. It has to be Amanda Peet. Amanda Peet has to be the only human.
And Miss Piggy plays Harriet Hayes, and it sounds perfect. I mean, it is just interesting. I guess I had never thought about the behind the scenes component, Tom, in terms of how integral it is. And when generally speaking, that's actually not great, in the sense that like audiences don't really care about the machinations of how something that gets made, generally speaking. But I think the Muppets do it from like an emotional place. Whereas,
but also, that's where the anarchy is.
Right.
The anarchy and things going wrong backstage, so that when they're out front and in front of the studio audience, everything can be smooth. And then they can do the typical, you know, gags and it all works smoothly. And so they get the best of both.
I fully agree with you. I think that it's... I agree with sort of, obviously, what you were all saying in terms of this razor's edge that the Muppets live on in terms of like anarchy and sentimentality and earnestness. Like, it's all a lot of plates they keep spinning, which is again why I think it's so hard to pull these off. But I think it's just, I don't know, I think it's just interesting to think about. Disney buys the Muppets. When did they buy the Muppets?
They bought the Muppets right before Jim Henson's death. I want to say it was 89, and he died in early 1990. And like a lot of his family has always sort of been like that deal and trying to maintain his like creative stake in the Muppets, like really contributed to his health taking a downturn. Oh God. So we can blame Disney for that too.
Well, what's interesting is that they buy the Muppets, but Muppets from Space is a Sony picture, if I'm not mistaken. So I'm wondering whether or not, forgive me if I'm making that up, but yeah, it was a Sony movie. So I don't know like what the deal is with the Muppets in terms of like, because they're back with Disney now, for sure. But I'm also like, I think that was the Muppets okay, that was Disney. I was just wondering about the Jason Segel movie, but it does feel as though like the rights to the Muppets is always kind of a question mark to some degree. But
I think there was a window in which different studios had purchased adaptation rights for the Muppets in which they could produce. It's sort of like how Fox had to keep making X-Men movies, or how Sony has to keep making Spider-Man movies. Those rights don't revert to Disney. I think it was like that. And Muppets from Space was such a bomb that Sony was just like, you can have these.
But it is just kind of fascinating to me that they haven't really found a way to capitalize on this truly beloved troupe of characters.
Well,
are they though?
In a generation.
I think they are, Emily. And to your point, I don't know if anybody will ever be capable of recapturing the magic again of those original creators of these characters, because I think there was a specific comedic sensibility. And to your point, Emily, at that point in time, in the late 70s, in the early 80s, there was something they were doing that was bold and anarchic and different, and something people hadn't seen. And now we're very comfortable with all these characters. What I think they could do is lean into the mascot thing. These are beloved characters as much as we love buying plushes of them and little things. They should just go all in and do more stuff at the Disney parks with them, not required of them to create new stories, to create new content. You can just evoke the great feelings, do an equivalent to like the Simpsons Land at Universal Studios, where you can just go and be nostalgic and live amongst this imagery and these characters that you love without them having the burden of having to continually try to recapture the magic in the form of a movie or a TV show or something. Right. That's what I would like to see. And I think that could work.
I'd go and stay in a Muppet hotel in Disneyland. Yeah,
exactly.
I think when I ask, are they truly beloved, is obviously I beloved the Muppets. That's not a word, but I beloved them. Yeah. And I think a lot of people our age do.
Thank you.
I think the generation that loves the Muppets is too small to really market to, because they, like, after Henson dies, they fall out of the public consciousness. Like, they keep making stuff, but it's just it's diminishing returns. And then when they made the big comeback moves with them, those never really hit to the level they needed to. Like, I would love if my kid loved the Muppets as much as I do, and I'm sure that I'll show them, you know, Muppet shit. But like, I do think, like, the fact, yeah, they've tried to do the merchandising thing so many times. I own a Muppets Monopoly game for some reason. But like, okay, so like a similar situation is I have like 10 billion Snoopies at my desk. Right. It seemed like I was taking notes. I was just drawing Charlie Brown. But I love Peanuts. Peanuts is like a formative thing for me. And okay. Peanuts now, they know there are no longer new comic strips, but they're continuing to make specials and movies and stuff. And they have so much merchandising shit they can do with Snoopy, especially in a way that I don't think, like, the Muppets are just not cuddly in that way. Like, who's, you know, Kermit kind of. I think they're just caught between a rock and a hard place where they need to keep making stuff for the Muppets to be relevant. But the people who care about the Muppets are this, like, micro generation.
And actually, it's funny bringing the Peanuts into it, because that might, it's quite similar in that Henson and Schultz are completely free of any cynicism. There's nothing cynical about the Muppets. There's nothing cynical about Peanuts. And at the risk of being cynical, I don't think there are many writers who will approach anything without a level of cynicism.
Hey, Emily St. James.
I don't think you can achieve that where it's so completely innocent. And what's the last thing that you've seen that you can say that about?
My solution to this is Muppet Christmas Carol seems to be the Muppets' pop culture foothold right now. Like, that's the thing people watch. That's the thing people love. I think they go all in on Christmas, because Christmas is like a time when we're not cynical. We're allowed to be sincere. I think they do like a spot, like they should do. This has long been my pitch. They should do a TV special with Josh Groban, where like an homage to the John Denver one, where Josh Groban just sings Christmas hits and the Muppets are there. He's a very good actor. But he also has that thing where like your grandma will want to watch him. So that's, and then of course,
and do it as an annual and get a new person every year or whatever. And then you only have to do one thing.
Can you sing, Tom?
Can you sing?
Can I sing?
Okay, you're doing one of these.
But I think you're absolutely right, Emily, that the Muppets and Peanuts are an interesting comparison point. I do think that Peanuts exists in sort of a different slipstream, though. Like one of the things I remember most about Snoopy was it insurance ads that he did for a really long time.
He still does those. I think he's still the mascot for MetLife.
Okay.
Schultz merchandised the fuck out of those characters.
Right.
That said, the same thing happened with Garfield, and no longer is Garfield as culturally omnipresent, even though his comic strip is still making new comics every day.
Those movies were really And there's a new bad.
Movie. There's a Chris Pratt movie coming out.
Hell yeah. Garfield.
I have a question, and I don't know the answer to this, and I imagine that you guys will. Which is that Muppets Take Manhattan comes out in 84. Mm-hmm. Muppet Christmas Carol is 92.
Yeah.
What's happening in that 8 years? I know Jim Henson is sick, and I don't mean to make light of that, but I'm just curious, because that's a big gap. And Muppets Take Manhattan was a big movie. Like, it was a hit. Just feel like...
Well, the Henson Company were doing other things.
They were doing Labyrinth.
Henson gets sick of doing them. He only did... Okay. Manhattan as sort of like a we'll give you the money to do Dark Crystal if you do another Muppet movie kind of thing. He didn't really want to keep doing
it. Sold at the time as the last Muppet movie.
Yeah,
like
really
very much in the sense of like we're the end of that is we're sending Miss Piggy and Kermit off into the sunset. Don't you love them? Now they're actually married. You can imagine this is the happy ending for the Muppets.
Sure.
And now they're all performing on Broadway. By the way, my Letterboxd review of Muppets Take Manhattan is one of my all-time masterpieces.
It is
an imagined conversation between two people who stumbled into the premiere of the show at the end of Muppets Take Manhattan. I like that. Like Henson wanted to do other things. Frank Oz's directing career was taking off. Like they were very much interested in not doing the Muppets anymore, but the Muppets ended up being the only marketable thing they could do. So then Henson had to sell the Muppets and like it just, yeah.
I mean, I think that there's been many, think pieces about your Dark Crystals and your Fraggle Rocks and your Labyrinths and how, you know, bold they were at the time and how kind of crazy it is that they got made and how beautiful and amazing they are. But it's also sort of understandable why those things just never like fully took off. Like when you watch something like Labyrinth, which I think is an amazing movie and I love it, but it does feel like a movie that's made for a very sort of specific group of people, if that makes sense. And Dark Crystal as well, where just like these are
even more so.
No. Freakish movies. I don't know what else to say. I love them, but it's just sort of it's interesting to me that, and I guess that's just the case of this industry, which is that once something's a hit and once people want you to just keep doing the same thing over and over again, artists get bored of doing the same thing over and over again. So I completely understand it. But so for Muppet Christmas Carol, just to go around the horn here, favorite song.
Oh, jumping right into favorite song.
This is a fucking tear off the Band-Aid.
Damn. I noticed when I last rewatched it.
This is tough.
And I was thinking in particular about the songs, how I think it's completely inspired to have so many of the songs sound so similar. They're really, really similar. It's as if there's a musical motif that goes all the way through when there isn't. It's just the songs kind of sound, you know.
No, they work. I mean, Paul Williams' work in this is just fabulous.
It was his first sober, I think.
Really?
He thought that he had killed his career through the 80s through drink and drugs and joined AA and NA beginning of 90.
Yeah.
Or end of 89, beginning of 90. And this was his first job after it. And he couldn't get any other work.
Really?
And she was like, oh, well, fuck it. I'm fine. I'm really fucked. I'll go and do a fucking Muppet film. And I think it's a masterpiece. The songs and are all.
I believe that Clay just grabbed his vinyl. Is that what just happened?
Yeah, I need to. I'm trying to figure out what my favorite. I'm trying to answer your question, this impossible question you asked, Phil. I think the one that pops back into my head the most.
It goes to Christmas.
Sleep Till Christmas.
Yeah.
Which one, sir? Yeah, okay.
One more Sleep Till Christmas, the one at the beginning of the movie where they are closing up shop and they are walking through town and it ends with Kermit. What a shot where he's now alone in the town square and he looks up at the shooting star and all that. They're all so good and they all.
Oh, but also that moment
held the story.
That
so
moment,
well.
which the shooting star apparently is a little nod to Jim Henson. But what I think is so bold is that you have this really beautiful, joyful song about excitement and we're going to have Christmas. It's one more sleep till Christmas. And this is what we've waited for the whole year. And it's families together and it's joyful. And what do? They go straight to the orphan rabbit shivering under paper. And I think that is so bold. That's so bold. And it's the last thing you'd expect from a Muppet film.
This movie's, like, spoiler, really sad. Like, this movie has this just ennui and, like, melancholy that's coursing through it that I was just, quite frankly, not expecting. Now, maybe
I
should have.
It captures the spirit of the Dickens.
Yeah.
That's what I was
perfectly.
Gonna say.
Yeah. Absolutely perfectly. And they do that by using, not only are they, you know, evoking the, as you said, Phil, the mood. and the message of the Dickens so well, but just they make this brilliant decision just to straight up use a lot of the prose from the Dickens, which it just fits so well. That's another one of these like inspired ideas that they came up with. And I want to say it was Jerry Jewell's idea, but that may be incorrect. I think it was, but it's like, why not? Dickens was a spectacularly hilarious writer. Just have Gonzo just say his words and it'll, and it's like, it's kismet. It's perfect.
I feel like Christmas Carol is one of those things that people, when you do an adaptation, you do a lot of the language from it, which is interesting because it's unlike Shakespeare, you know, where it's meant to be on the stage. But like, I think because Dickens every year would travel around reading it out loud to people, so it got this feeling of like a stage performance. Yeah, Dickens was like a huge celebrity, and people like would line up to, he was the Taylor Swift of his day, line up to see him read A Christmas Carol. But yeah, I think that the language is so often preserved, and I do love the way this special does that. I just looked up Paul Williams' career, and absolutely, Tom, I'm like, he does the Muppet movie and that ends on Rainbow Connection, which is like all-time king shit. And then he kind of like disappears. And he does songs for Ishtar and shit. Like he is around, right. But this is really when he comes back.
Everyone's favorite musical, Ishtar. Yeah.
So thank you, Paul Williams. I had remembered him working with the Muppets way more than he did. He really just did Muppet movie in this one, and like, but those are the ones I remember all the songs from. So
I want to just for a quick second here, in terms of the casting, I think there's a phenomenal bit of casting, which is that they originally wanted Jack Lemmon to play Scrooge, but Jack Lemmon wanted to play Kermit.
That's awesome.
He wanted to play Cratchit?
Kermit. I think he wanted to do the voice of Kermit. And producers were like, you're crazy.
Oh, because Kermit now, yeah, they had to find a new Kermit. And Jack Lemmon was like, yeah.
I think Jack Lemmon would have made a great Kermit, honestly. I think he could have done it.
I just think it's great. I also, you know, you guys have talked about how well directed this film is. And it is very, very well directed and very difficult to do, but I also feel like it makes it look easy when some of the effects that they did in this film were pretty groundbreaking and really hard to do. Like all the ghost stuff, they like submerged Muppets in water so that they had this like weird kind of watery vibe to them. I mean, the ghost of, is it Christmas Present, is fucking terrifying.
No. Christmas Past, Phil. You're talking about the tiny little ghost girl?
Yeah. Sorry. Past.
Awful.
Fucking horrifying. Yeah. Haunts my nightmares. I'm just like, it's, I also quite frankly think that the third one, which is often sort of this kind of Grim Reaper-y kind of figure in all the iterations, is still also quite upsetting. But first one, I was just like, this is not for children. This is a terrifying creature.
You had such a sheltered childhood. Like, I just...
No. Yeah, maybe I did.
You're gonna, like, have you watched the 1973 Richard Williams version that I'm making you watch? That's
not gonna, yet. I'm gonna watch it tomorrow.
That's like that. The ghosts in that, which I saw as a kid, are so fucked
up. I'm scared to watch a lot of things that we have to watch. I'm scared to watch Hellraiser 3 for this podcast. I mean, there's a lot of things that I'm worried about.
One of the ideas initially was Gonzo was going to be the ghost of Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Muppets were going to be the ghosts. Apparently.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then they slowly got rid of the idea of Piggy being the ghost of Christmas Past and whoever it was, probably Fuzzy for Present. Sure. And Gonzo, they kept right up until the very end. They were considering having exactly the same setup as they have now, but just with his nose coming out of the shadow of his hood.
I'm quite pleased they
didn't. Yeah. Because I love the moment where Gonzo says, on the arrival, they're peering out through the church door and he's like, this is too much, this is too scary, we'll see you at the finale. And so they're even commenting that this is gonna fuck all of your kids up.
Yeah, but it's also when I was a kid watching that, it made me feel okay for being scared.
Yeah,
I was not embarrassed about. As a kid, I was a real scaredy cat. I was media sheltered to an extent. Sounds like Phil was, and I like Large Marge in Big Adventure terrified me. I went behind the couch for 30 minutes. I wouldn't come out. But that bit, and that's a really lovely, and that's to your point, Tom, there is a wonderful, unique sincerity and lack of cynicism to the Muppets while not being simplistic or childish. And it's like the Peanuts. They were able to hit that mark, Schultz and Henson, in a way that few others have been able to. But I really appreciated that as a little kid when they said, this is too scary, we're going to see you later. I felt like, okay, this is scary. They're acknowledging this is scary. I'm not embarrassed for being scared of this. And yeah, that was really a lovely thing, I think, to put in the movie.
That's another quality I think the Muppets had in the late 70s, early 80s, that other things didn't, that fourth wall breaking.
Yeah.
That now everybody does. So now it just doesn't feel as cool. But that was kind of part of the anarchy of it all.
Yeah. I think that first of all, I think that makes total sense, Clay, in terms of giving you permission to be scared and giving you that's part of the fourth wall breakage too, of like acknowledging that an audience is there and how they're feeling is also part of, I mean, that's the variety show angle too, right? Which is just sort of the constant acknowledgement that there's an audience there. I think that theatricality to everyone's point is also something that makes them feel like a bit of a relic, because it doesn't feel like we have the same sort of unbridled theatricality that we were allowed to have, you know, say 20 years ago or so, which I think is maybe even more than that, I think is interesting. I also agree with you, Tom, that had the Muppets been cast as the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future, they need to be scary, right? Like, you need to feel the gravity of their presence in order for you to buy into Scrooge's art. Scrooge's, right? Because, yeah, like, if... Sorry, yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, Bill. No, please, that's your thought.
Pretty much done. Yeah.
We have come to the gist of my issue with Muppet Christmas Carol, which is, again, I have to admit, this is a very stupid criticism. I am not a fangirl about anything. I'm a fangirl about Peanuts, but like...
Excuse me?
No, sir. Like, here's the thing. When I say fangirl, I mean like uncritical, where I want things, like I get very upset if things aren't my vision in my head, like some people are with like Superman or Batman. And I'm a huge fan of Peanuts, but even like when they do new things, like in the Peanuts movie, which, you know, in many ways makes huge shifts with the characters, I thought it was fine. I apparently am a huge fangirl for A Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
And so what I want is, I want it to be all like, if you have beloved characters doing it, I want them to play all the roles, except I do think it's fine to have Scrooge be someone. And if it's, but otherwise, I want it to be kind of scary. And like Muppet Christmas Carol uneasily straddles that line for me in a way that I think is so personal to me and like not worth caring about, because clearly this is way better than Mickey's Christmas Carol. But Mickey's Christmas Carol to me is like the platonic ideal of, we've got this huge cast of like characters who are going to play all the roles. And I think that does make The Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come still pretty scary, because, you know, he's still a shrouded figure. But that said, I was talking about this with my wife, and the problem is, when you do it with a bunch of characters, is you need somebody who can do sincerity to play Bob Cratchit. Kermit can play Bob Cratchit. Mickey Mouse can play Bob Cratchit. We were saying, what's the thing that you could do this with now? And we came up with Nintendo characters, but I don't want to see Mario play Bob Cratchit. That would be so bad. So like,
are you sure you don't want to see that?
It's a Tiny Tim. Oh my gosh, you're going to die. Actually, no. That's good. Let's do it.
Yeah. I mean, so Emily, we did we do Mickey's Christmas Carol?
I don't know. We did Mickey's Once Upon a Christmas. Mickey's Christmas Once Carol comes out in 83. And I rewatched both it and Muppet Christmas Carol for Peter at Vox, where I talked to a 6-year-old about both of them. No, a 5-year-old about both of them. And she had many trenchant observations that I enjoyed and appreciated. But at that time, I like had it deflated me how much worse Mickey's Christmas Carol was than Muppet Christmas Carol, because I'd been saying the reverse, but it was just because of when I grew up. If I had grown up with Muppet Christmas Carol in the way I did Mickey's Christmas Carol, I might feel the exact opposite. I might be like, because like the Looney Tunes version of that, nobody watches anymore because it's bad. You can't like Bugs Bunny as Bob Cratchit doesn't work. The Flintstones version is bad. Right. Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol like works, but nobody watches that because nobody fucking remembers who Gerald McBoing was.
What about Patrick Stewart's Christmas Carol? Are you?
I mean, that's not like I don't like that. Like,
I love like Jean-Luc Picard, but that Patrick Stewart Christmas Carol is, he is some of the most buck wild line readings I've ever seen in anything.
That's on the other side of the ledger where it's like we're trying to do a straightforward adaptation.
Right.
Muppet Christmas Carol is like the one that tries to do both. And like, I think that that is a bold creative choice that I would appreciate more if I weren't a whiny little baby.
So wait, am I mistaken? Was there not a recent FX Christmas Carol?
Yes, did
I
make this it's up? It's not good.
Guy Pierce?
Yeah.
Who was it?
And it was a series, right? It was like a limited.
Yeah, it was Guy Pierce, I think.
It was Peaky Blinders guy wrote it.
Hold on. No, I'm like.
Oh, Stephen Knight.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was Guy Pierce was Scrooge. You're right.
Yes.
Joe Alwyn was Bob Cratchit.
Good for him.
Okay. Andy Serkis was the Ghost of Christmas Past, I believe. Yeah, they tried to do it as a limited.
Apparently, I have not seen this, but I had a drink with our mutual friend Brian Cogman the other night, and he was red in the face telling me about how horrible and disgusting this thing is.
Can't wait to check it out.
he was beside himself.
So,
So
can we all agree that Fozzie is our greatest living comedian, like stand-up comedian? Yeah. Fozzie, who doesn't get enough to do in this movie. I love Fozzie.
No, but there was one moment. It was Fozzie's entrance. Because
Yes, sure.
Expressing your love can look many different ways. And with the right jewelry gift from Blue Nile, it can truly sparkle. Blue Nile's collection of classic diamond jewelry makes for the kind of gift that speaks volumes without saying a single word. Or switch things up with a sapphire piece sure to spark conversation. Either way, Blue Nile's diamond guarantee ensures you get the highest quality at the best price. Express yourself with Blue Nile, the original online jeweler, at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
What I love about this, more even than anything, any other Muppet iteration that I've seen, is Muppets and humans interacting. Mm-hmm. It's completely, they're all there, but also animals. So you'll get Muppet horses and real horses. Everything is blended. And then Fozzie comes in with the girl who Scrooge falls in love with. And he said, this is a friend of the Fuzzywig family. And my first thought on watching it now was, do Muppets and humans...
fornicate?
Yeah, okay, we'll put it like that. Yeah. Do they shag in this world?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, Fozzie's definitely getting it on.
Absolutely. Thank you for bringing this up. Yeah.
So Scrooge is getting sloppy seconds with Belle? Is that what you're saying?
There is a Mrs. Fozziwig, but you know what?
That's true.
I think that,
but it's his mother.
Oh,
that's it. Yeah, that's played by Fozzie.
Or does he
mom.
Just call her Ma because olden time people used to call each other Ma and Pa?
Oh yeah, it's
mother.
Well, it's like Pence.
It's like my Pence calling his wife mother.
So they own a rubber chicken factory, which I think is inspired.
Love it, chickens.
I just think that, like, and I understand why. First of all, you know, less is more probably when it comes to running time on movies with kids, just because their attention spans are short and all of that. And I get why this movie is short also, because, like, I imagine it's an impossible feat to make these productions. But there is a part of me that feels like I just kind of wanted a little bit more with some of the, like, you know, heavy hitters that they have on their bench. Again, this is nitpicky because I think that ultimately they made the right choices in terms of not using them for Ghosts of Christmas Past or for the, you know, various ghosts. Okay, so let's
dive into the issue you run into once you have a cast of characters that large that's so beloved.
For sure,
you're going to have that criticism with anything they do if you have favorites and they don't get as much screen time in certain things. But Phil, one tidbit. You'll enjoy this. You'll probably all enjoy this. To your point about what a difficult production these are, and to again what kind of a mad genius Jim Henson was. When you do this thing, this puppet up show at the Henson thing, if you get the VIP ticket or whatever, it includes a tour of the studio, and that ends with going into Brian Henson's office with your little group, and Brian Henson holds court for 10 or 15 minutes. And he just answers questions, talks about things, shows you different things in his office. And he's got this big piece of furniture, and on it is all of the slates, all of the like final slates from his dad's three Muppet movies and then his two Muppet movies. And the thing he points out is that it has, you know, like the number of setups that they did, you know, throughout the thing. And all three of Jim Henson's slates from his three Muppet movies, the number of setups are all within like two or three of each other. He did all three of those movies with almost identical numbers of setups. Sure. And then Brian Henson's are very varying, but also have like 1,000 more setups. Like Jim Henson just knew exactly in his head every single thing he needed. And just did it, and made these things. And Brian Henson's was like,
I don't know what I'm doing.
I have no idea. It's far more difficult for me.
I think
for
my dad.
I do think, Phil, that to your point, the genius, the one thing that Mickey's Christmas Carol does well that this doesn't is it knows who your favorites are, and it spaces them out in parts where Goofy's Marley, Mickey's Bob, Donald is Fred. You're going to see them a few times throughout, like except Marley, who only is in the one scene. And like, I honestly do think having Statler and Waldorf as Marley throws this off a little bit in a weird way. Like if you had a specific Marley, like I love them as Marley. Marley and Marley is my favorite song, which nobody asked me, but now I'm telling you.
Oh, interesting.
You. But like, I do think so like it skews expectations in a weird way, at least for me. A Christmas Carol and Muppet pedant, apparently.
So I want to kind of dive into this young Scrooge and Belle situation for a second here, because I feel like this is the aforementioned song that was cut from this movie, which is, what's the name of it?
When Love Is Gone.
When Love Is Gone. my apologies that I didn't know that.
This piece of shit, Phil. When Love Is Gone, you prick.
So it's, I don't agree with, I believe it was Katzenberg who said, cut this song, right?
Lore is and this song is not in the proper, this is not in the theatrical release,
not in the VHS you have on your,
it is on the VHS that is the first time how it was. So it was not in the movie, it's not in, when people saw it in the theaters, when Tom saw it in the cinema in 1992, this song was not in it. When they put it out on VHS, they put it back in. So everybody who grew up with that, you know, with the VHS, when I bought that DVD in 2001, 2002, whenever the DVD came out, I'm assuming Tom kind of alluded to having the same experience. They skip over this song. I thought I was having some sort of like a medical issue. I was like, wait, what is happening? And rewound it. And I was like, what is going on? And they took it back out for that. So for years, once I switched to DVD, I would watch the movie, pause it.
Oh my God.
To get back to the menu on this DVD, you had to take the disc out and put it back in. So I would take the disc out, put it back in, reload everything. It has this infuriating mid-2000s menu, and everyone's like, you know what people want is when you put the DVD in, you have to watch 3 minutes of some bullshit before it lets you click on anything. And it's Kermit going like, oh, hi, welcome to the blah, blah. And like, just, and then you have to go to the special features and watch the song. And then take the disc back out and put it back in.
God.
And go back to the... Because I refuse to watch this movie without that song. That is the linchpin of the emotional arc in this movie.
I have so much respect for that. So much.
Can I ask a question,
My wife stopped watching the film when they cut that. When it went to DVD, She was like, where's the song gone?
Yeah.
She, as a very sad child, would sing that song on repeat.
I love this so much. Go ahead.
My question is...
But it's really important because the very final song is When Love Is Found.
It's a reprise of something that doesn't exist in the movie. So,
I don't disagree with you guys, but I do have a question. Okay? I just want
to clarify that for a long time, the issue was that they didn't have an HD enough master of it, so they couldn't do it on the DVD, and then they found it and like remastered it.
Yeah, for years there was a movement. There was from the time I joined Twitter in 2009 or whatever, it seemed like every Christmas time there was this very vocal, ever-growing movement of where is Love Is Gone? Put Love Is Gone back in the movie. Every time anybody interviewed Brian Henson, they'd say, oh, by the way, can we get Love Is Gone back in the Muppet Christmas Carol? And society just hounded them for so long that they finally, their story was they couldn't find the footage. And then like 2 years ago or 3 years ago, they found it and they finally remastered it and put it back in the movie on Disney Plus. But yeah, it was this thing that for some reason society felt like Tom and I very strongly about this.
I guess my question is like two questions. The first is, why do they care? Like, is this Katzenberg still like
is a test audience?
They thought it would be boring for kids.
Yeah. No. I mean, everyone wants this fucking song in. Put the fucking song in. Like, just put it back in. Like, why is this?
Well, that's why they put it in the tape, you know, because at that point he was like, well, what does it fucking matter now? But no, it was a test audience thing. And he looked around during that song, an 85 second song. And he looked around and some kid was like looking at the ceiling or, you know, picking his nose. And he's like, oh, God, this is going to ruin the movie. But Katzenberg also had terrible instincts. He tried to cut Part of Your World or something from The Little Mermaid. He was an unreliable force.
He got steamrolled by Musker and Clements on Little Mermaid. But Brian Henson didn't have a similar level of power. I will say I had never seen this movie with that song until I watched it this year. I don't think you need it. I love it. It's a good song. I think the movie works without it.
Oh, no.
I think the movie works without it.
Hot takes from Emily. So,
you know what? I don't think it's a marginally better movie having it in there. I don't think it's a significantly worse one without it.
But you know what you lose, Emily? Even if you think story-wise or emotional arc-wise, it's not absolutely necessary, which is we disagree on that, but I'll grant you that. What you lose when you cut that song out is some of the most heartbreaking acting Michael Caine has ever done.
Sure.
When he walks up behind Belle and he is singing along with her and his voice breaks, and if they had left that in the movie, Michael Caine nominated for an Oscar that year. That is some of the most affecting, and I'm Phil's face. I'm, you know, partially kidding, but Michael Caine's performance is just unreal.
I'm with you. I think this is his best performance of his career.
I'll go with you on that.
He would have bumped Al Pacino in Scent of a Woman. We would have had a much better reality.
Okay, so that was going to be my question. Of the five nominees, who gets bumped? Al Pacino for Scent of a Woman, Robert Downey Jr. for Chaplin, Clint Eastwood for Unforgiven, Stephen Ray for The Crying Game, or Denzel Washington for Malcolm X?
It's definitely Robert Downey Jr., but I'm terrified it's Denzel. Like, because those are the two guys from movies the Academy didn't embrace. Wrongly in the case. Actually, no, Chaplin got several nominations. It's probably Denzel, which is fucking terrifying.
You don't think it's Stephen Ray?
Crying Game was huge. Remember? It got so many nominations.
Denzel was a big, 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 big star.
Denzel was a big, 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 big star. Like, people loved that performance. But people were mad at that movie because Spike Lee, they were mad at Spike Lee for saying accurate things about race in America.
So to get back to your hot take for a second here, Emily, because I do think that my issue with When Love Is Gone,
all right, here we
is
go.
less to do with the character, the arc, and the acting. It has to do with the song, which feels like they shoehorned like a Les Mis song into this movie that just doesn't.
My
kind
wife
of,
loves Les Mis.
This yeah, Les Mis, I love Les Mis a show with not, great songs.
I'm all right. All right. Yes, I love Les Mis, but it tonally feels just kind of odd. Again, I like the song. I think the song it works fine. I obviously agree with Emily in the sense that like it's better that it's in there than not, but I do sort of feel like It's a little tonally strange. That's
also, and this, you know, is a slightly more, it's an academic thing because it's not to do with the story, it's to do with history. But this is the first thing the Muppets did without Jim Henson. And that's the most perfect song for, and it's partly why it breaks my heart, is got a Muppet film and they're talking about the singing about the death of Jim Henson. You're a stone cold hearted.
Yeah.
Did you think about that, Emily? That it's about Jim?
Phil's Les Mis slander and Tom's Jim Henson voice have brought me around on this. It's the film needs it. It's impossible to imagine it without it. And I'm so glad that I've finally seen it. I do agree to speaking to the larger musical point. It is nice to have it serve as a counterpoint to the reprise. So, And I think
love Les Mis. I was in Les Mis at summer camp. I was Jean Valjean. I love Les Mis. I'm not slandering.
I would love to see you as Jean Valjean. I would.
There is video of it that will never be seen.
Put it on YouTube, Phil's mom.
But Phil, that's what, again, we keep talking about what's special about the Muppets, and it's that they are attempting this thing that doesn't totally work for Emily, but I think is very unique, that they are not afraid to throw in this purely sentimental, sad thing that maybe the kids will lose interest for 80 seconds. Maybe there's kids out there who hit the fast forward button because they were impatient. But I think it makes it an undeniably, I think, richer experience. And I think part of that tonal, you know, inconsistency is the wrong word, but that sort of odd mixture of tones and things is that's at the core of what the Muppets are doing. I think you watch Emmett Otter's Christmas, which Henson,
so good,
you know, but that Henson made that's Christmas. That thing is deeply melancholic. There, you want to talk about weird songs to have in a Muppet thing, watch Emmett Otter's Christmas. There's full-on Les Mis style, no jokes in it at all, sentimental songs. You know, I think that is kind of carrying over part of the Jim Henson energy into this movie.
I want to be clear that the only reason I have this feeling about the Muppet Christmas Carol is that I watched Mickey's Christmas Carol at an impressionable age, and therefore my brain was irreparably warped by it. In some ways, only being allowed to consume evangelical Christian culture as a child was the best thing that ever happened to me, because I have no strong feelings about the way Star Wars should be. I'm just like, yeah, seems fine. Do whatever you like. But for fucking Christmas Carol, it better have Mickey Mouse in it. That's the way Dickens intended.
As Dickens intended.
Yeah. So the Christmas scat, I kind of love. The song that's just like them just like scatting is great.
That shot of Kermit walking on with Tiny Tim on his shoulder was the hardest shot of all. And I read somewhere it took like 30 people to operate Kermit and Robin.
Yeah, because it's like a rolling thing.
The barrel that it's on. Yeah.
So you brought up Tiny Tim. Tiny Tim breaks my fucking heart. Ugh. And I'll tell you why. The sickly color green that Tiny Tim is absolutely crushes me.
My and son insists that he has the plague. He won't.
Does he not have like tuberculosis, or what is he supposed to have in a Christmas
Carol? He's riddled. I did look it up. What Tiny Tim has, and there's a long list. He's not well.
he's the saddest Muppet that's ever been, and the fact that they don't even fix his coloring for the
guaranteed,
end.
Guaranteed. Every single time I watch it. For the last 30 years, when he coughs, I absolutely piss myself. Oh. It's the funniest thing in the entire film. It's perfect. It's perfect.
Yeah.
It's perfect. Wonderful.
One of the greatest lines and line deliveries in all of cinema is when Gonzo says, "And Tiny Tim, who did not die.
Oh, I absolutely love that. It's so good. It's phenomenal. I really think that, and maybe this is just me being overly sentimental, but I think that all this stuff with this family, and obviously this is sort of the beating heart of this story, and you're supposed to have all these feelings about this family. The casting of Kermit and Mickey Mouse, Jesus Christ, you got in my head. Miss Piggy.
Kermit and Mickey Mouse as gay dads is such a good proposal. Phil, pitch it.
I mean, I would watch it, but I just feel like it makes it so much more emotionally potent to have those them be sort of the parents of this family. And it really, as much as I complained earlier or had slight reservations about them not being more prominent in the movie, when they are on screen and when you are with this family and you've got Tiny Tim and all of it, you're just like, Jesus Christ. Like,
you've
this
got decades of
hard.
Love and goodwill coming with.
Yeah.
And it's such a fun thing to see. It's this like alternate reality kind of thing where Piggy and Kermit, like their characters, they have this, their romance is so tumultuous and goofy and he's always trying to get away and then she gets him back or she's, you get to see here, what if Piggy and Kermit settled down and they were a loving, supporting, married couple with children who have each other's backs? It's
a shame that the kids aren't monstrous frog pig hybrids. There's a missed opportunity. Or maybe that's why Tiny Tim's, that's what's wrong with him.
It's
interesting.
He's mutating.
Is Robin, who plays Tiny Tim, the worst Muppet? Yes. The answer is yes.
What? Yeah. Based on what?
I mean, I have a long-standing grudge against Robin from other Muppet productions, but I don't like Robin. I think he needs to go away.
How could you have a grudge against this Muppet?
He's the Scrappy Doo of the Muppets. Get rid of him. Throw him out the door. Throw him out.
I do like that we get a little bit of Miss Piggy's sass.
Yeah,
she's ready to fight someone.
Oh, at the end when she's like, "I'm gonna raise you right up off the pavement," I'm like,
that's good. This is good stuff.
So it is wonderful that we are covering the year 1992 because I don't like Tiny Tim as a character. There, I said it. I feel like he's just pushing the sentiment, like in the original book. Like this is just he's pushing the sentimentality a little too far.
Flipping through
this
her burn book,
you're fucking killing like the sacred lambs.
But
here.
Listen. This year, 1992, is when there is suddenly a beef war in the Journal of Infectious Diseases about what exactly Tiny Tim had. The first proposal is renal tubular acidosis, a type of kidney failure. Then someone proposes rickets. And in 1997, someone finally wrote about how he obviously had tuberculosis spondylitis or TB of the spine. And like this is what people were doing in the 90s. They were having beef wars about fictional illnesses.
And now, 2023, it's officially plague.
Yeah.
And it's plague. Yes, yes, all four of those things that can be healed by your father's employer being nice to you.
Correct.
Do you think this is why the United States has terrible employer-based health insurance? People just read Christmas Carol and like took that out of
Yeah. That sounds right.
My son also said he's 8. And the other day we were working out which Christmas films we're going to watch when in the run up to Christmas. Sure, right. And Muppet Christmas Carol is always the last one we watch the day before Christmas Eve, always. And he was talking about Tiny Tim with the plague. And he said, you know what my problem is with Tiny Tim?
Fuck yeah.
He will not shut up about how brilliant everything is. And these were my son's exact words, 8 years old. I mean, Tim, open your eyes.
You're not wrong.
Be realistic.
The saintly dying child is just this element of Victorian literature that I think inevitably marks it as Victorian literature. And like, I think Dickens was a crazy genius, but he would sometimes be like, here's a poor person who's a saint. Therefore, shouldn't they deserve to live? And be like, I mean, but also like, a lot of the poor people who aren't saints also deserve to live, Charlie. So,
right, but Charlie it also Dickens. Serves as a lesson, as a counterpoint to Scrooge, who is rich and has everything and is miserable and sees no goodness in life and everything, but saying, "Look at this little sickly child who's afflicted with TB and the plague, and those two
and
other
rickets.
Things Emily said
yeah,
that
and
I
rickets.
Can, rickets. Yeah. And rickets and then the first one, but that person with nothing is able to see goodness and light in the world. And of course, every part of this is built to be a lesson for Scrooge.
Sure.
But I think it's beautiful. It works.
It is beautiful.
It works on me, guys. It really works. Up in the spirit.
It really does. Once you get into the Kermit and the Cratchit family or what have you, it really does kind of take the film to the next level for me. Not to say that I didn't like it prior to that, but that's when it really got its hooks in me.
You were hiding behind the couch from the Ghost of Christmas Past is what you were doing.
Yeah,
so you
for
didn't
sure.
see it. Yeah.
And maybe I'm a sucker for Tiny Tim / Robin. You know, maybe that's what this is, but, I also love the spider Muppet. I don't know their name, but that song's great, and he's just great, or she. I'm not sure.
They. That's okay. They're gender queer. Yeah.
That's cool. We'll talk about where this falls on the queerphobia scale. I'm very curious to see where this falls on that. I think that Kane in the Cemetery is amazing. I mean, he really is bringing all of his tools to this movie. It's pretty incredible.
He's my second favorite Scrooge after Alistair Sim. It's either him or George C. Scott. I think they're both brilliant in the role. I want to ask Tom this question. Scrooge is a role that if you are have a British accent, you will probably be asked to play at some point in your life. How do you approach roles like that have been like played a kajillion times and people have very firm ideas of what they should be?
Well, you just fuck everyone else and forget everything that's happened before. But what's particularly brilliant about Kane's version is when he has so much fun being mean at the beginning.
Yeah.
Scrooge. Like, yes. He enjoys taking the piss out of Honeydew and Beaker, and he enjoys tormenting the rats who work for him. He makes jokes at them, and he allows Scrooge to smile and to laugh at his own cruelty, which I can't remember other Scrooges doing that. And it just brings, it makes him so much more human, that he's not just the bad guy, the bad Scrooge guy.
Yeah.
And I think that's where so many people go wrong when they're playing any kind of baddie, is that you're allowed to kind of enjoy it.
I think the thing that is really great about him is you see how his enjoyment of being bad and his enjoyment of being good are just two sides of the same coin. He's the same guy. He's just like flipped some switch inside himself. And now he's going to get great delight out of being just a joyful presence. And before he got great delight out of being a scornful presence. And I do think that's such a great take on the character.
Yeah, he enjoys the meanness. He grows to enjoy the joy. But the one thing that he can't deal with, and the one thing that his Scrooge is desperately trying to hide, is the sadness. And so that's what that's why When Love Is Gone is so important, Emily.
I'm on your side now. It's Phil who hates that and Les Mis. Yeah, go ahead.
That's when he really discovers this deep well of sadness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Henson does such a good job of conveying that stylistically as well. I think the first 20 minutes of this, I mean, the whole thing is beautiful. The first 20 minutes of this movie, the way he shoots Scrooge's home is cinematic. It is so dark. Especially for a children's movie, really bold. It always unsettled me as a child, not just in how cold and dark and gothic it is, but the way he frames the loneliness, the way his sitting room is designed with the one chair, no furniture except for the one chair in front of the fireplace. And he does this like low wide angle shot that isolates Scrooge in everything in this, and the emptiness of his apartment reflecting the emptiness of his life. It's just, I think it's really, really smart.
It really is.
Direction.
It made me, it really stood out when I watched it this a few days ago, because those scenes suddenly reminded me of The Lighthouse, Robert Eggers' Lighthouse.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a kid's film.
Yeah.
And so you're doing, taking everything, the darkness of that film, you can find 30 years ago in a kid's film, and then however many years, maths years before that in like the cabinet of Dr. Caligari and things like
that. Sure. That.
And I would sincerely put these scenes on a par with that. And then just really exquisite stuff like the arrival of the Ghost of Christmas Past being this really bright, blinding light behind his the curtains of his four-poster bed.
Oh.
Everything is just so... It completely elevates it because it's not what you'd expect from A, a kid's film, or B, a Muppet film, or C, any kind of Dickensian.
Yeah.
The one thing that we have so many of is Dickens adaptations. I don't know how many of them get over your side, but the BBC, just relentless Dickens adaptations. And this stands out even amongst those.
No, it stands. And I always go back to that opening song, the Scrooge song. What is that? It's actually just called Scrooge. Yeah, it's called
there
Scrooge.
There goes Mr. Humbug, right?
There goes Mr. Yeah. Humbug. Introducing, what a brilliant way to introduce the character. And obviously the town talks about the main character is a trope in musicals to introduce somebody, but introducing the setting, the period, there's something so tactile and so evocative about the close-ups. I love they just stay on his feet and the close-ups of the cane hitting the cobblestones and making that ding 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 ding. And it's just like I think it's something that when you're not making a Muppet movie, maybe you're not thinking about as much if you're doing an adaptation of this that is kind of more straightforward, but focusing on how like wet and dirty and stone and cold everything is in this town, like those tactile details are really, really rich in the opening of this movie.
Those sets are just so perfect. And I really do think that opening shot coming across the rooftops.
Great shot.
And then, you know, seamlessly going down into the square. Yeah,
that model is gigantic. That model was the size of a soundstage.
I love it.
And it bookends the movie, right? Like you're going in and then you go back out. I mean, and speaking of the end, which it's a little bit of a trope, I guess, to some degree of Muppet things, but like getting to see all the Muppets together in the house is just, I don't know about you guys, but like every time I see this massive cast of characters in one space together, it's just hard for, like, it just has to warm your heart. Yeah. There's just something so lovely about it. And you really do feel that they're like a family. And this troop of characters that are all sort of bound by this thing that they do, I just absolutely adore. I wanted to bring up one other thing. I'd be remiss if I didn't bring it up because it's a Patreon episode that is coming out, or maybe might be out by this point. Have you guys seen the Doctor Who Christmas Carol with Michael Gambon? Is this something that you guys have seen by any chance?
No,
I have.
No?
I don't remember anything about it, but I have.
I did a Christmas episode on the Patreon of with Liz Hannah and her husband. He picked this Doctor Who episode with Matt Smith and Michael Gambon, which is sort of a Christmas Carol episode. And Liz Hannah picked, obviously, the Christmas episode of Studio 60. But everyone's favorite Christmas episode. But I bring it up just to say that, and Tom, I know you're the biggest Doctor Who fan. I know that's your favorite. It's your favorite thing. If you could see Tom's face right now, he doesn't, for our listeners, like Doctor Who. Yes, Tom?
I don't dislike Doctor
Who. No? You don't like
Doctor Who? It depends on the Who.
On the Doctor? Sure. So all this being said, Michael Gambon has a really kind of great Scrooge, right? Like, as you can imagine, Michael Gambon was a tremendous actor, and he's bringing a lot of really interesting energy to it. And it's Doctor Who, so it's like this potpourri of like sci-fi and all these weird things mixed into it in order to kind of do what Doctor Who does. But it does feel, and this kind of alludes to Emily's question to you, Tom, in terms of how Ebenezer Scrooge is this staple of British actors, right? This idea that Kane's your favorite? Is this your favorite iteration of Scrooge? Are there others that jump out at you?
Sim.
Okay, Alistair Sim. Okay.
Although
hard to touch.
Also, Finney, I liked Finney's as well.
Interesting. Okay.
Sim is my favorite. Yeah. I ranked like 18 Scrooges once at Vox, so go find that.
I remember fun. That.
Yeah. Scrooges Have ranked. Fun. Yeah.
It's the ultimate Scrooge ranking.
it's just interesting to me that it feels like this bearing wall of a role that don't have a ton of differences. Like they all sort of alluding to what you were saying, Emily, that they're all kind of indebted to the Alistair Sim performance. Yeah. Even also, and I think Kane's great in this, but I'm saying, yeah.
Like that's someone mentioned Shakespeare earlier, and that is the difference between Dickens' characters and Shakespeare's characters is Dickens didn't make them quite so ambiguous.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot that you have to do, whereas Shakespeare, you can have 1,000 Hamlets and they'd all be completely different.
Because, right.
You know, he wrote with such ambiguity.
Yeah.
Thoughts on the movie Scrooged? Yeah. Fans, not fans?
Don't like
oh,
it.
Oh, wow. Just a lot of thumbs. Okay, so thumbs down.
I do not care for it.
Yeah. I don't want to say it's actively awful, but like, I don't like it.
I think if it doesn't have Bill Murray in the lead, it's actively awful. Yeah. I think Bill Murray makes it watchable. Otherwise, yeah. I find it really unfunny and off-putting and mean. And I don't care.
Off-putting and mean. I will give you
I also hate anytime someone is like, I feel like I'm in the Christmas Carol, and they're just literally doing a Christmas Carol. No, you're just say, I'm in a fucking Christmas Carol. What's happening to me? I don't know. It just.
No, that's right. It's the only reason I ask the question. Have you seen it, Tom? Are you a fan of Scrooge?
Yeah. No, I'm just staying quiet.
I remember seeing Scrooge in the theater. I believe my mom took me to see it. And it weirdly has this kind of in my DNA Christmas association. I mean, I don't watch a ton of Christmas movies, but this one weirdly, I don't know why I have an affinity for it, merely for probably nostalgia reasons, because I've watched it relatively recently. And I agree with the assessment that like, it's kind of a mess. Like I like Carol Kane in it. And I like some, you know what I mean? Some of the various kind of character actors that pop up, and like Bill Murray's just doing Bill Murray. But it's also like a very strange Richard Donner energy to it too. That's like, it's just a very odd movie.
Well, apparently the story, there's that Murray wanted to do it a little more sincere and kind of lean into the Christmas of it. And Donner wanted it to be manic and absurd.
Which makes sense.
I'm fascinated by how often the Christmas stories we love are riffing on Christmas Carol to the degree it's usually just like this person is out of step with the season. Charlie Brown Christmas is not really a Christmas Carol, but Charlie Brown not quite getting the Christmas season is like the spine of that. Similarly, It's a Wonderful Life is in that vein. And I think like one of the things that makes that so effective is, you know, this is a time when we're all supposed to feel happy and none of us do. And like it's unexploiting. Like, I mean, I feel very happy watching my kid open presents and things like that. But like, there is that little kernel of like, oh, this is another year gone. This is another year in my life that's passed. I'm heading on the way toward death. Wonderful. Happy Christmas. And like, I think that this story is about that inherent contradiction. And anytime a Christmas story explores that, it's good. And anytime it's not, it's on very shaky ground. Like even fucking Gremlins does this, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A Christmas classic.
But it also wasn't the original story. Wasn't Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol one of those pieces of media that sort of invented what we think of as the modern way we celebrate and talk about and think about the Christmas holiday?
Our modern conception of Christmas is very driven by two periods of time, which is 1840s London and 1940s America, and like that's basically all our Christmas culture comes from those two eras, like
Dickens and the Coca-Cola Corporation.
Well, but also like people being sad about World War II and not having the boys home. So like a lot of our classic Christmas songs are from the 40s, but like our conception of a snowy cityscape is very Dickens.
So just to sort of piggyback on this, because again, Jewish, don't know a ton about Christmas, but I do sort of feel like the aesthetic that you just outlaid, Emily, is also
I mean, where does that aesthetic come from? Like, do you sort of know what I'm talking about? Like, the when you think of Christmas, you're thinking of a sort of very specific types of drawings and like all that kind of
stuff. Well, Phil, when we do the Richard Williams Christmas Carol, you'll see, because that is specifically done in the woodcutting style of the illustrations from Dickens' book. And A Christmas Carol, unlike some of Dickens' work, was an immediate sensation. It sold out everything. Okay. People fucking loved it. It like, yeah, it is... I think it's probably the most famous Christmas story, surpassing even the one where, you know, Jesus is born. So,
you know, yeah. The one where
that one.
But also at the same time, that's when Prince Albert brought all of the old Bavarian approach to Christmas to England.
Yeah, there's a really
wanted it to, you know, wanted some of his influence. And that's what then Dickens picked up on and created the English Germanic Christmas that spread.
You mean the Brits co-opted other people's culture?
Weird.
Right. It's weird. It's weird. There's a really fascinating book by, I believe his name is Stephen Nissenbaum. It's called The War on Christmas, which is basically Christmas had nearly been exterminated by the time of Dickens because it was a holiday of people getting super drunk and breaking into rich people's homes. Like, literally, that's what it had become.
Like the Purge?
And so, like, what happens is, like, in the late 1700s, Washington Irving, an American writer, writes this totally made-up thing
aware of his work.
About, like, this British... You've heard of Washington Irving?
Yeah, I know.
Like, he writes this totally bullshit thing about a Christmas back at home, and it's, like, this made-up British family Christmas, and then people start taking that and running with it. And Dickens is the one who's like, this is a holiday for being with your family, this is a holiday for taking care of the poor. He invents our modern conception of Christmas, which so now we don't get drunk and break into rich people's houses, but maybe we should.
I'm just thinking
the purge
origins, and it's Christmas. Yeah, 1691.
Would watch.
Yeah,
man,
we have awesome. These like weird little remnants of that. Like there's these groups in Philadelphia called the Mummers, and they go around and sing carols. Caroling is a remnant, like trick or treating, of a time when that was a much more violent tradition. People would come and sing a song, eat you up.
I was thinking about this, Emily. Now we're just spinning off into just completely unrelated Christmas things. But which is the carol where they're singing, bring us some figgy pudding? I wish you a Merry Christmas.
Oh, you listen to the lyrics of this song.
And most of this song is them saying, bring us some figgy pudding or we're not leaving. Like, we're going to fucking stand outside your house and sing until you bring us figgy pudding.
All these
like,
old...
This is so aggressive.
Ugh, these old Christmas carols have two messages, one of which is Jesus is here, he's going to save us, and the other of which is give us our fucking presents, you fucking rich
give
people.
Give us our fucking presents.
Yeah.
I would be furiously Googling, like, what the hell... what is figgy pudding? And they're just out there getting louder and louder, and I'm panicking.
Is it
like,
pudding
I don't
with
have
figs
any
in
figgy
it?
Pudding.
Is it pudding with figs?
Yeah, I believe it's pudding made with figs.
I don't have figs at the ready. What? I'm fucked.
I just be like, come
euphemism.
In.
I thought it was prison talk for something awful.
Come in. I'm going to make you a little French toast. That's what I'm going to do. But like, you know, a fruitcake is also from that time because you could make a fruitcake at any time of the year. And if it's properly stored, it will keep for literal decades. So like you could just have a bunch of them on hand. And if a bunch of people came to your house and were like, we're not leaving until we get some fucking dessert, you could just be like, here's some fruitcake. Good for
you.
Funny
you should say that. I've got some fruitcake I made in March.
Let's rate this film. I, as I mentioned, had not seen this film previously. I really love this movie. I came into this at an 82. I'm now at an 86. I think it's a great movie.
Is 82 your base rating for things you haven't seen?
No. What?
Oh, he watches the movie and is like, here's my thought. And then he comes here and we change his mind.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Before starting.
So before this podcast, before we spoke of this, I was at an 82.
Right.
You have spoken of it. I'm now at an 86. I have gone up. I think it's a great movie. I mean, I will definitely watch it again. It makes me want to fill in my blind spots of Muppet films. Especially curious about this Most Wanted. The prison one sounds interesting.
Mm-hmm. It's not bad.
And Treasure Island. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'll put those on my iPad to potentially watch on a plane. It seems perhaps like a good
plane movie.
Okay. What about you, Clay? What's your rating on this film? What did you think in 92 or when you saw this first? Not in 92, obviously, yeah. Since, you know.
I mean, but, like,
and
I said,
now where are you?
It's impossible to be objective or to look. I mean, this was, to me, again, this was the Muppets. This is what the Muppets were. So there's no moment in this movie that bumps for me or, you know, disappointingly subverts my expectations of what the Muppets should do or what sure. I'm not like, there isn't enough Piggy, because this was all there was. This was what Piggy was to me. This and like Muppet Babies, which was, you know, also just kind of its own thing. But I genuinely, and you know, there was a period in my life in college or whatever where I was the person who was like, wouldn't fucking shut up about the Muppet Christmas Carol and Emperor's New Groove. It was like the kids thing that I, you know, took in and made my personality, you know. In 2007, uh-huh. I was anyone who would listen. I was like, but they took Love Is Gone out, and they're like, all right, you know, whatever. So I have no objectivity to this. In recent years, I have appreciated it more and more and more and more as a film, in terms of the craft, in terms of it is a absolutely immaculately put together movie that is completely effective. I think the script, one thing we didn't talk about is why do some Muppet things some things are just good or not good because of how good the script is. I mean, this is a funny script. This is a well-written, this is wall-to-wall banger lines in this movie, which isn't always the case, and it elevates this one. I started at 100. I'm at like 100. I'm at a, it's 100. Is that where this maxes out?
It's 0 to 99, but yeah, you 100, sure.
Okay, so it's a 99 then.
Okay.
No, well, say 100. Break the scale. Do it.
Yeah, it's 100. Yeah, break the scale. Honestly, this is a, without Love Is Gone, this is a 99. With Love Is Gone, it's a full on hundo. Yeah.
Tom?
I mean, you don't watch it every day, every year since 1992, unless it's high in the 90s or 100. And if we're allowed to go to 100, it's 100. It's okay. Like Clay said, everything that Clay said, I agree with. It's we haven't spoken enough about how funny it is.
Oh, my God.
And I think Rizzo and Gonzo, that's
Rizzo,
one of the
we
best,
didn't talk about.
One of the
so
finest
good.
Double acts.
The jelly bean
kills
gag.
Kills it in this movie.
The jelly bean gag, where he says, "Those were in your pocket. You had them the whole time." Brilliant. Yeah.
And then not only that, when he says you're so weird or something, and Rizzo gives Gonzo a kiss on the
kiss
nose.
Him a little kiss on the nose. You are that, such an idiot. Oh.
Every time kills me. Love it. Not only is it hilarious, but it makes me cry every time. I'm not ashamed to say it. I cry a lot.
Which part makes you cry? Parts?
No, at the end. It's so joyful. Okay. It's so joyful. I love it. The songs are great. Just the direction, if it wasn't a Muppet film, people would talk about it as being one of the... He should have been nominated for Best Director that year.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
If this was just human beings, the same aesthetic, the same sets, the same direction, everything, if it was just people... People would have been like, he's the new Tim Burton. But people would have been so fucking excited about Brian Henson.
Yeah.
And he just kind of gets
it
lost.
It is a shame that he, well, because like Muppet Treasure Island does pretty well. I think it's just, again, it's timing. It's just a little bit of cynicism. People just not really knowing. But all that being said, Emily is
also
capable of tears.
So
I don't imagine she cried at this.
Brave. Sort of, you know. No one, we haven't spoken about how it's a really brave choice.
It's true.
Of them to do this. Every decision they made is fucking ballsy. And it's a real talk about big swings. That's a huge swing. And I think they absolutely smash it. 100.
Emily?
My film, former film critic self, who watches a lot of movies and tries to think about them, like came into here like in 87. And probably this discussion would bump her up to a 90, but... The me that is at the bar with all my fellow Christmas carols, that's what we call women who love Christmas Carol, just fucking yelling about this movie, 75. She's like, it's fucking fine. but it is no fucking, and I rattle off like 17 other adaptations, and somebody would be like, no, but it captures the spirit. And I'd be like, it does fucking not, Leah. And she'd be like, you know that my name is Carol number 17 here. So,
so Emily, here's my question to you. When do you make your movie called A Christmas Carol about a woman named Carol?
Oh, Phil, the Hallmark Channel has already done it. It's been taken.
Oh,
it's been taken from me.
I was gonna say, there's no
it's
way.
It's actually, it's called It's Christmas Carol.
No.
Jesus. That's worse.
Queerphobia scale, I'm giving this a one because the Muppets are queer friendly. They are allies. They celebrate absolutely. Queer love. Yeah. Go Muppets. Totally. Now like somebody's going to take that out of context and boycott the Muppets.
Scrooge is not.
Scrooge is, I think Scrooge is an equal opportunity employer. He's shitty to everybody.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. So next week, we are covering the aforementioned Home Alone 2 Lost in New York with Carolyn Framke. Curious. I know, Tom, you just watched it recently. Yeah. Feelings about it in regards to the first, or just, you know, Christmas movies in general?
I mean, it's that they're playing the old hits.
Yeah, when, not as well. Well, it's a little broken too, if you ask me.
Yeah, except it's boosted for me because it's boosted in Canada because I believe they cut Trump from it.
Which I respect.
Tim Curry. Tim Curry, absolutely brilliant in it. Absolutely brilliant. He's so unique, and he can go absolutely huge, but you still buy it. And I would never cringe at a single line of his, no matter how big he does it.
Sure.
But then he is one of my favorite actors.
You'll find out next week. I had some issues with that film, but I was at a Christmas party last night. Some friends of mine threw, and they had it on TV. They had it on a VHS copy on TV that they were running in the like 4:3, you know, whatever, however many P that is. And like, I liked it better that way. So.
But I actually believe that. Cause I mean, I think that the love that people have towards Home Alone 2 specifically feels very nostalgia based for me. I think Home Alone 1 is unimpeachably a great movie. Like, it's wonderful. The second one feels like generationally, like my roommate, for instance, who just is all about it. She's like, it's great. He gets a limo. And I'm just like, I don't know how this is. This doesn't.
It really is because we watched Home Alone 1 yesterday. Mm-hmm. And it really is all the same jokes, exactly the same jokes. But I think they do it in such a, this is the reverse of Muppet Christmas Carol. It's so cynically done. It's that we're just going to take your money. You want to see the traps. We're going to do pretty much the same traps. What's so perfect about the first Home Alone is it's absolutely airtight.
Sure.
The reason for everything is absolutely airtight. And the setup and seeing all of the things already that are going to become traps and seeing the reason for the phone going, for the alarm clock not being on, the reason that they lose his ticket. Everything is so perfect. And then they do kind of
it's so sweaty.
But they've
in the
already got
one.
Your money, so fuck you guys. Yeah. Happy Christmas.
I do think, though, that the pigeon lady belongs in a Dickens movie.
Yeah, she's very Dickensian. Of all of my friends, Clay, you feel like you're the most likely to have experienced a real life Home Alone situation. Is that accurate?
What?
You just feel like maybe you like rigged up a house to scare off some burglars.
Yeah, I could see it.
No, I that is certainly what appealed to me about those movies first time out. I did not have, shall we say, the resources that were available to Kevin McAllister growing up. I was not the son of a multi-millionaire or whatever the hell's going on in that movie. But yes, no, I love those traps. I do love those traps. And that's why as a little kid, I was like, oh, Home Alone 2. This is the one where things really get violent. So I'm loving this. These guys should be dead. When Marv takes those bricks to the forehead from a four-story building, his cranium, it would have been splattered on everywhere. Absolutely splattered. He would be so incredibly dead. But that's why I love the violence. But as an adult, the first one is a much richer text.
The bricks to the head, I am ashamed to say, still make me laugh every time.
Oh, it's the performance. Daniel Stern,
the use of a skeleton when he's when Marvin's electrocuted, have a skeleton.
When he's fully electrocuted for a good 30 seconds. Yeah, he should be dead. Clay, tell our listeners where they can hear your dulcet tones and your other podcast.
Oh, sure. Yes, I host a show called Screen Drafts, where we bring on movie experts and enthusiasts to what we call competitively collaborate in making best of lists. They alternate putting picks on a best of list from a topic, starting at 7, working their way up to 1. Sometimes we do things that are a little bit crazier, because the next one, I mean, this is coming out Christmas Eve, so yeah, starting in January, all of January is Scorsese month at Screen Drafts. We are doing a Scorsese super draft, ranking all 29 of his theatrical features, plus the No Direction Home Bob Dylan documentary, because that came out as number one on a miscellaneous docs draft we did on our Patreon. So those 30 movies are going to be ranked from 30 to 1 by 3 different groups of guest GMs. The first group is Team Podcast Like It's. So Phil and Kenny and Emily are taking the bottom of the list. The middle of the list is going to be Joe Reed, Chris File, and Katie Rich, who have done some great episodes on our show together before. And then rounding out the top of the list is Roxana Haddadi, Oriana Nudo, and Brian Cogman. So we're doing all of those. In between, we are doing a draft of the Scorsese-produced movies, things he produced but did not direct, which is a fascinating group of films. And that is going to be Team Max Film, our friends from the Max Film podcast. So that's going to be Iffy Wadaway, Drea Clark, and frequent guest Inku Kang. Alonzo Duralde, as always, busy writing a book or something. So he was unavailable for that. And then our very own Ryan Marker and the great film writer Mariah Gates are going to be doing a draft of the World Cinema Project Criterion titles.
Wow.
Which is the foundation that Scorsese started to remaster, restore, and highlight great international movies from underseen directors and things. So we are really doing the whole gamut, soup to nuts, all Scorsese, all January. So if that sounds up your alley, check us out. Screen Drafts. It's going to be crazy.
I will say, having obviously spent some time reacquainting myself or filling in blind spots on Scorsese and what have you, we as you know, cinema connoisseurs, what have you, constantly talk about how brilliant Scorsese is. But watching these films, it's given me kind of a whole new appreciation of just how wide and varied the spectrum of his talent is and what he's capable of. It really is just sort of, and obviously, you know, with Killers of the Flower Moon currently out and you know, he's back in people's top 10 lists and people are talking about him, but it is you kind of can't really wrap your head around just how majestic a talent he is and his love of cinema and every nook and cranny of it. It's right. Why, like, whenever fucking Twitter or whoever decides to get all up in arms because he said a slightly you know, off color thing about Marvel, and you're just like, do you know what he's given us? Like, do you understand what he's done for cinema? Is just, yeah, it's a staggering achievement.
And that's why I'm excited to do these interstitial drafts in between the super draft, because contrasting with Spielberg, who we did this for last year, we did all Spielberg month. Sure. Is you look at the films that Scorsese has produced, and he is really fully dedicated to using his position in Hollywood to help female filmmakers, help filmmakers from underrepresented communities get movies made. 100%. And it's a great group of films, that one, and the World Cinema Project movies as well. So it's I'm very excited to have all of my these friends returning to the show to spend the month of January talking Scorsese with us.
I already know Phil's going to try and put New York, New York in the bottom 10, and it's not going to happen.
Ooh,
you're
a preview.
A lunatic. Are you crazy?
I like that movie. I don't think it's, you know what? Maybe it is in his bottom 10. He has such a rich filmography, but I'm going to do it just to spite you. I'm going to get it into the middle 10.
You are not into the middle 10. And speaking of into the middle 10, if you are a member of our Patreon, the Booster Club, you will be voting on.
You're a monster.
One title. If you agree with Emily that something like New York, New York needs to be elevated from the bottom to the middle, we will be holding a vote in our Patreon for Booster Club members of one title to protect to get to the next part of the draft. So one title is going to get a bye week and be protected straight out of the bottom to the middle. And we'll do it again from the middle to the top.
If that title happens to be The Departed, you might see Kenny have an aneurysm on mic.
Well, I'm fully ready for that.
Emily, and you just like New York, New York, because you like Babylon.
You've got a rollover veto as well.
Oh, I do, don't I? Yeah. I've been hanging on to these things.
Things you don't even know you're hanging on to.
Yeah. You know what? I do think New York, New York probably belongs in the bottom 10, but I'm going to see if I can get it. I'm going to get it to 21 is what I'm going to do.
It's going to be great. A little preview. Guys, you're the best. You're my favorite new team that we have on this podcast.
It's my favorite new team as well. We didn't even bring up that the last time Tom and I were on the show, we talked about Bram Stoker's Dracula, which was still in theaters. Yeah. When Muppet Christmas Carol, it was a mid-November movie, so it was still in theaters. You could have potentially done a double feature, and what a double feature!
Muppet Dracula does need to happen.
If Universal didn't have a stranglehold on those stories, Muppet Invisible Man. Oh man.
Well, this is okay. So this will be my final question for you guys, and I'm sure you haven't. Maybe you've thought about this. I don't know. Because it does feel like everyone's like Muppet X. Do you have like a, this is the one that I think Muppets should tackle? I mean, you said Dracula just now, but like, is there a classic of some sort that feels that it hasn't been Muppetized? Muppet Frankenstein?
You asked this last time we spoke, and I think I said The Road.
Oh yeah, you did.
And I haven't been able to get that out of my head.
Muppet No Country for Old Men.
In terms of public domain stuff, my general answer is Pride and Prejudice. I think that there's some beauty to that being a Muppet story. I don't know who you make the one human. Maybe the dad. Maybe like the dad of all the daughters. I also really want to see Muppet War and Peace and just like really be a faithful adaptation of the novel. Takes like 5 episodes of television.
It's
a limited series, and it's the Muppets doing War and Peace, and the one human is Napoleon. Yeah.
I think I agree with Emily. Pride and Prejudice is the way, although it is the central thing of the story is a romance, they clearly don't want to explore. I mean, they did a little bit with Muppet Caper, but I don't know how far they want to go with the Muppet and human romance angle.
Well, that's the thing about Pride and Prejudice is there's no like sexual component to it because it treats it as strictly a financial thing. So I think this should go further than any adaptation in that regard as well. It should just be graphic.
I think there is maybe something to be done with Shakespeare as well. I'm trying to think of these ubiquitous works.
A Romeo and Juliet,
or Romeo and Juliet,
A Much Ado About Nothing,
or a Hamlet,
right,
or Titus Andronicus, and when the kids are pie and given to, chef comes on,
the Swedish,
put them in a pie.
What? Yeah, it does. This is maybe my
still,
most.
There's still Sam is the nothing Eagle. More terrifying, even as an adult, than the Swedish chef having human hands.
Oh man.
I didn't realize he had human hands until I was in my 30s. I was like, oh my God, those are human hands. It just hit me all at once.
Oh, Christ.
It's horrible. In fact, I'm no longer at 100. It's down to 99.
I will say, I do feel like maybe, and this sort of comes back to what we were talking about at the very beginning, which is I do feel like it feels like we're just not mining this in a way that we could. Like, it does feel as though, as much as I might enjoy these two kind of Muppet movie rebooty things, there's just so much IP out there, so much public domain stuff, so many things that could be done with the Muppets, and it feels as though we're not doing it, unfortunately. It's a bummer. Yeah.
I'm trying to think of another Christmas story the Muppets could do, because I don't think Muppets Nativity is going to fly.
I don't think that not. Will fly. I mean, I would watch a Muppet Hanukkah.
Yeah,
for what it's worth.
Yeah, maybe they do one of the other Dickens Christmas stories, which are all very lovely. The Cricket on the Hearth would be a good Muppet.
Oh, okay. I didn't and know.
Do
he
them
had
as
other...
a whole. Do them as a like the Three Sugar Netflix thing, yeah. Where it's a bunch of kind of lightly, things connected through that. Yes, the source material.
And if that fails, just do the Nativity, and the only human is Baby Jesus,
played by Tim Curry.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not going to do better than that. The shepherds, Merry Christmas, everybody.
I mean, you've got the wise men. I mean, Kermit and Piggy are Joseph and Mary, and you got Gonzo and Fozzie and Rolf are the wise men.
Listen, the shepherds come down from the hills and they're like, the angel came and told us that the baby was born, and you look in the manger and Tim Curry's, and there he goes, I bet you weren't expecting to see me, eh?
Sam the Eagle is the king who's trying to kill Jesus.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Happy holidays. Thank you both so much for coming on here and talking about this with us. Oh, we can't wait to have you back.
I love you guys.
Anytime. Tom, as always, an absolute pleasure.
Likewise.
The highlight of my year.
Thank you so much, guys. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.